Today is Friday, October 2nd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, with just a month to go before the U.S. presidential election, the only thing that's certain is uncertainty.
President Trump equivocated and repeated unsubstantiated charges of massive fraud from mail-in votes that could undermine the election.
How technology is helping in the fight against the spread of COVID-19. Also ahead, an iconic band who didn't get to do its originally scheduled tours due to the pandemic offers fans the next best thing. It's all on today's International Edition. During Tuesday's raucous presidential debate, President Donald Trump warned that he won't go along with an election result based on mail-in ballots he alleges are fraudulent. To prevent the spread of the deadly coronavirus, some states have expanded voting by mail, and polling indicates significantly more Democrats than Republicans are relying on this method to cast their ballots. In addition to the likely possibility Trump will challenge the election results in court if he loses, VOA's Brian Padden reports there are growing concerns. This campaign will also try to persuade the Electoral College to overturn the popular vote in states where Democratic candidate Joe Biden is deemed the winner.
At the end of Tuesday's presidential debate, the two major political party candidates were asked if they would refrain from declaring victory until the election results were independently certified. Democratic candidate Joe Biden agreed.
Once the winner is declared after all the ballots are counted, all the votes are counted, that'll be the end of it. That'll be the end of it. And if it's me, in fact, fine. If it's not me, I'll support the outcome.
But President Trump equivocated and repeated unsubstantiated charges of massive fraud from mail-in votes that could undermine the election.
I am 100% on board. But if I see tens of thousands of ballots being manipulated, I can't go along with that.
However, Trump's own FBI director, Christopher Wray, has said there is no evidence of widespread mail-in voter fraud this year. Trailing in the polls, Trump has indicated his campaign will mount legal challenges to contest mail-in ballots if he does not win, challenges that could end up being decided by the Supreme Court. Meantime, the Supreme Court nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett to replace the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is being pushed through the Senate by the president and his party. There is also reporting that Trump, citing voter fraud, may ask Republican-led state governments to override the popular vote in the Electoral College if Biden wins. The Trump campaign has denied these reports. In the Electoral College, established over 200 years ago, state legislatures use the outcome of the popular vote to select electors from the victorious party who then cast the official ballots on behalf of the population of their respective states. Overriding the popular vote, analysts say, could greatly undermine public confidence in democracy itself.
And that you could see then enrage many of its citizens who had voted and anticipated that their votes would count.
The Electoral College has become increasingly controversial after declaring George W. Bush the winner of the 2000 presidential election, and then again in 2016, awarding Donald Trump the presidency, even though both lost the national popular vote. While many Democrats now advocate for abolishing the Electoral College, Republicans defend this indirect voting system because it allocates proportionally more electors to rural states.
So that means candidates have to try to appeal to a much broader, wider segment of the American populace rather than just going to the big cities and campaigning there.
This potential new Electoral College controversy over mail-in voting, analysts say, could end up producing no clear winner. In that case, the House of Representatives would be called upon to choose the next president. Brian Padden, VOA News, Washington.
European leaders will continue a two-day summit today on difficult and pressing foreign policy issues relating to Belarus, Turkey, and Russia after a long day of discussions Thursday that lasted well into the evening. Joining us is reporter Catherine Field in Paris. Catherine, sounds like after that very long day on some very volatile issues, there were some decisions to come out of it.
Yes, indeed. More than 7 hours of negotiations between the 27 leaders of the EU nations. This was a summit that was deliberately solely just for foreign affairs. So they had a lot to get through. They agreed on Turkey, that there needs to be more dialogue between Turkey, Greece and Cyprus. In the last couple of months, there have been increased military tensions there because Turkey has been drilling for natural gas in territorial waters belonging to Greece and to Cyprus, two European Union members. So there, the EU is very firm. It has to go to dialogue. The EU doesn't want to go any further with Turkey because it needs to have Turkey as a partner when it comes to economics, with security, and of course also with migration.
And was there any one particular issue that they seemed to indicate was the most pressing or really top of mind?
The situation in Belarus. The 27 spoke with one voice and said that new sanctions have to be implemented against the current regime, those responsible for the violence against the demonstrators. These will be put into place as soon as possible. And when they were questioned about this, that met on Friday. 40 individuals will be subject to sanctions, although it has been confirmed that Lukashenko will not be one of those 40 individuals who will be sanctioned. But there was again call for support for the demonstrators and call for any way forward for some sort of dialogue to bring an end to the situation in Belarus. Of course, this comes just after talks that the French president had with opposition leaders in Lithuania who are in exile.
And what about escalating tensions between Armenia and Azerbaijan and Turkey's potential role or alleged role in aiding Azerbaijan? Were they able to speak with one voice on this issue?
When it came to Nagorno-Karabakh, there was immediately agreement between all of the members around the table that there has to be a ceasefire. And in particular, they also called for an end to any country who is supplying military weapons to either side. They're very concerned. This is a military dispute right on Europe's borders. It has the potential to spill over into Europe. And what the EU want is an immediate ceasefire. And they want anybody who is providing weapons or even providing some sort of soldiers, you know, some sort of to the Azerbaijanis, for that to end, that this whole dispute has to end now.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. As Catherine mentioned, a volatile situation continues following major escalations between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the disputed territory of Nagorno-Karabakh. Armenia is blaming Azerbaijan ally Turkey of shooting down one of its warplanes and killing the pilot Tuesday. Turkey denies the allegations, but the event has only intensified the decades-long conflict over the region. Joining us from Istanbul is reporter Dorian Jones. Thanks for being with us. So what is the situation on the ground?
We've seen intense fighting between Armenian and Azerbaijani forces. According to the latest reports, over 200 people have been killed, combatants and civilians, since hostilities started on Sunday. Both sides accusing one another of targeting civilian targets. And this fighting does seem to be continuing to escalate, with both sides bringing more forces to bear.
This thing has been escalating since Sunday and then further escalating following a downed plane where the pilot was killed on Tuesday. And Armenia and France is accusing Turkey of sending Syrian rebels. Is that what you're hearing?
That's right. Armenia earlier this week claimed that one of its fighter jets was downed by a Turkish fighter. Ankara has strongly denied this allegation, while at the same time, Azerbaijan also said it's out of the question. In fact, a senior presidential advisor to the Azerbaijani president in a briefing said that two Armenian fighters crashed, but they said they crashed because they flew into a mountain on a mission, even though at the same time Armenia has been providing pictures of one plane that does appear to be a fighter jet that had crashed. It's unclear, though, who is responsible and why this plane crashed. And also on top of that, we're now getting growing allegations accusing Turkey of facilitating hundreds, possibly even thousands of Syrian fighters to back as Azerbaijani forces fighting in Nagorno-Karabakh. Now, Ankara has strongly denied this. They said this is out of the question. But we have heard independent reports, including Reuters news agency, quoting Syrian rebels who they claim are waiting to be deployed by Ankara to Azerbaijan. Now, Turkey has used Syrian rebels in another conflict in Libya, in the Libyan civil war. Turkey has deployed well over 1,000 Syrian rebels to back the side that they are supporting, and they were a key factor in the successes in that conflict. So Turkey does have a record of this, but Ankara is staunchly denying the latest claim that they are using Syrian rebels in Azerbaijan. But this is a major concern, not only to the direct players involved in this conflict, but also it's expected that Russia, which has Dagestan state and Chechnya bordering this conflict zone, where they have been fighting jihadi forces for several decades, and the prospect of Syrian rebels, some believe possibly to be linked to jihadi groups, going back into that region will be a major concern for Moscow and also Iran, which also borders the region, and they are very concerned about Sunni radical groups and Sunni Syrian fighters.
This has, as you said, been an ongoing decades-old conflict. Why has it escalated so much in the past week, besides the downing of the plane even before that on Sunday?
Well, we did see an eruption of violence in July, a major skirmish, which wasn't over Nagorno-Karabakh, but between the frontier, direct frontiers of Azerbaijan and Armenia. It was a very intense exchange, which resulted in the death of an Azeri general. But speaking to senior Azerbaijani officials, they say that these tensions have been steadily building up over the months. They've accused Moscow of providing over 500 tons of munitions in the last few months. And at the same time, Azerbaijan has been voicing frustration. As you said, that this conflict goes back to the 90s. It says a large part of its territory, Nagorno-Karabakh, is under control of Armenian separatists, which they say is unacceptable. And also a large swathe of Azerbaijan itself is also under the control of Armenia following the conflict dating back to the 90s. And there are tens, if not hundreds of thousands still of Azeri refugees who want to go back to these areas that are currently under the occupation of Armenia. And we are hearing now demands from the Azerbaijani President Aliyev, and also strongly supported by the Turkish President Erdogan, saying that this fighting will only stop when Armenian forces withdraw from all of Azerbaijani territory.
Besides the general neighborhood concerns of this conflict, how far-reaching around the world are these implications and some of the major world players saying?
Well, you have to realize that where this is occurring is in the Caucasus, which is one of the most conflict-strewn regions in the world, decades-long conflicts which have all remained unresolved. And it isn't just confined to the Caucasus. Russia considers this area as its backyard. And also now we're seeing Turkey taking a more assertive role. You also have Iran, which has influences, major regional players which all have their own rivalries. And the fear and the threat is that this conflict could end up sucking in various players, making it a far more broader conflict. And that's why you're hearing calls from the United States, France, and Russia calling for an immediate ceasefire. But what we're hearing from Azerbaijan and from Turkey is that can only happen when Armenian forces withdraw. And for now, Yerevan have said that is out of the question.
Reporter Dorian Jones in Istanbul. One of President Donald Trump's closest aides, Hope Hicks, has tested positive for the coronavirus. Hicks traveled with the president to a rally Wednesday and tested positive on Thursday. Meanwhile, at the University of Arizona, students and staff are using an app that lets them know if they've been exposed to someone who has tested positive for coronavirus. Michelle Quinn reports on how the app gives health authorities the ability to fine-tune advice to people who've been exposed.
At the University of Arizona, students are encouraged to download COVID Watch, an app developed on campus that lets them know if they've been exposed to someone who's tested positive for the coronavirus. The app also helps determine the person's risk of getting infected based on that exposure, providing health officials with important information to help tailor their advice in each case. Joyce Schroeder, a molecular and cellular biology professor, is the campus lead working on the app.
The campus itself has the ability now to set the exposure notification levels. And what does that mean? That means that if we want it to be really, really sensitive and pick up the smallest potential exposures, we can set the app so that it's going to notify somebody with the smallest exposures. We can go all the way in the other direction and set it so that it's only notifying people if they're absolutely, no question, heavily exposed to somebody.
Around the country, officials are turning to apps like these to help in the fight against COVID. They are using the technology to figure out when to notify people who've been exposed and what to tell them to do next, says Jeffrey Kahn, director of Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics.
There's a little bit of laboratory of the states happening. So Arizona may do something, Virginia may do something else, and we will learn. You know, maybe we won't learn everything we need to for this pandemic, but everything we learn in this pandemic will be useful for the next pandemic.
The standard health recommendation now is if you're exposed to the virus, you stay home for 14 days. But Samir Halai, co-founder of COVID Watch, says technology like his app gives health officials the ability to personalize what they tell people to do.
And we individualize the quarantine recommendation based on your specific exposure history. What we're also now adding is personalization, where we can look at your specific risk profile, your age, pre-existing conditions, and things like that. Then those are some things we can use to personalize recommendations even further. We need to be more nuanced about what we ask people to do.
The app can work based on a community's specific needs, Halai said. A city with few cases may want to notify and lock down everyone who's been exposed. A city with a major outbreak might not be able to do that and would set the app to notify people most at risk. But the first step, getting people to download the app. Nyla is a student at the University of Arizona.
I had, privacy questions about it. Like, I wasn't sure how much information am I, like, giving my name? Am I knowing exact people who, you know, oh, that person has had contact, like, stay away from them. I didn't know if, like, that was the energy behind it.
Hayes is also a University of Arizona student.
I've, like, read up on it a little bit, and honestly, I feel pretty good about it. I don't know. I know there's, like, they've done a lot of stuff to avoid privacy issues, so I think it sounds pretty legit.
University officials are in a race against the virus, hoping the app will help them to keep people safe and allow the campus to stay open. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
Survivors and their families are pushing a special UN tribunal in Tanzania to quickly act in trying elderly tycoon Felician Kabuga on charges of financing the 1994 Rwandan genocide after France's top court ruled on Wednesday that he could be handed over for prosecution. Kabuga was arrested in Paris in May after a two-decade manhunt. He's accused of financing ethnic Hutu militias who killed hundreds of thousands of Tutsis and moderate Hutus during a 100-day period in 1994. But the tribunal in Arusha, Tanzania, will face legal challenges and bureaucratic delays as it prepares for the trial. Kabuga's lawyers say he's too frail to extradite. Joining us is attorney Richard Gisagara with the Rwanda Community Association in France. Thank you for being with us. So are the survivors and their families that you work with pleased with the Paris court's decision to extradite?
Much pleased by the court ruling. I must say that I'm not really that surprised. I have always been positive, thinking that the decision is going to be good. But, you know, there is always a risk of even though that you think that you are right, that you have the rights are on your side. Sometimes you may have a bad surprise, but I was always positive, so I was not that much surprised by the court ruling. But on the other hand, as a lawyer and also as someone who is interested in humanity, we consider that like the beginning of the end of the impunity that man has benefited from more than 26 years now. Mm. But there is a worry now. We are worried first because he's going to be handed in 1 month to the international justice, the mechanism. The problem is that with the experience we have with this mechanism, the International Tribunal for Rwanda has always been long in the rendering decisions. Dossier hearing takes really long time. And now we are worried that because Kabuga is an old man now, even though I think that he pretends that he's more old than he is. And his health also have some problems, even though I continue to think that also that he somehow exaggerated accurate also. But the fact is that he's old and that his health is not the way it used to be a long time ago. So we are worried that if the process takes as long time as it used to be, maybe he will pass away without rendering account to the humanity. So that's the first worry I have. On the other hand, also, I have some regret because the international justice, who have now the duty of rendering the justice with Kabuga, who is a big fish when you talk about genocide, it's going to be in a court which doesn't give any room to the victims. You know, the international justice, it's only the case going to be between Kabuga and his team of lawyers against the prosecutor. So the victims doesn't have any room in this kind of, in the international justice. So that's also some regret that I have. I would have wished that be judged in Rwanda, for instance, or in other country where the victims can have room, like the word to say. Hmm. But that's a really minor regret that I have.
So your ultimate wish would have been to have this case tried in Rwanda. But yeah. If not there, you obviously feel this is better than in France. Why was he trying so hard to keep it in France?
I didn't want him to be judged in France. Either in Rwanda, either in Arusha. Because in France, I know I am really familiar with the French justice now. It is also as long as the international justice. So I'm sure that if the case was handed to France, he will not be judged before at least 5 years. So now the international justice have a big file already, even though some are worried about the time it will take, but they are more advanced than the French justice. Mm. So it's better that he be judged in international justice or rather than in France.
Any other reaction from survivors, victims that you have spoken to since this decision?
They are all of them are they welcome that decision because, you know, justice is a big step for reconstruction of victims. They all need justice. Now, some may feel now we're more than 20 years after the fact, after the genocide. Some think that they have been forgotten. Some other also are worried, saying that, thinking that these people, these big fish, you know, you don't have many big fish who have been judged. So they were afraid, saying that they will never see justice for these big fishes. But the case of Kabuga, this is giving them hope. Now they think that maybe it's not too late. That's really very good. That's a hope which is given to the victims. Some have this kind of discouragement, thinking that it's too late now for having justice. But with this case, they have seen that it will never be late, that the justice, the criminal against humanity is not prescriptible. This is a fact which comes to show that it's a reality, that the non-prescription of crime against humanity is a fact. On the other hand, also is a hope also for people like us who are working hard so that all these people be accountable to what they have done. This is also showing us that even after 25 years, we can get results. So this is encouraging us to continue to do what we do, because if a person like Kabuga, who was rich, has been arrested, then we can think that also other people who are less powerful than Kabuga may also be arrested, maybe after 30 years, even after 50 years.
Richard Gisagara with the Rwanda Community Association in France. Kabuga has called the charges against him lies, and his attorneys argued that the court hearing his extradition case had not properly examined all international arrest warrants. You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. Italian scientists this week showed evidence of Martian saltwater, raising hopes of finding tiny Martian life swimming in it. NASA says an air leak aboard the International Space Station doesn't threaten the crew. And SpaceX's next batch of Starlink satellites will need to find another ride into orbit. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has the week in space.
2-1-0. Ignition.
At Cape Canaveral in Florida, SpaceX Thursday canceled its launch of the next batch of Starlink satellites. This video from August shows a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket carrying 57 satellites to space. The company says its manufactured constellation will provide internet service to underserved parts of the world. But astronomers warn they will not be able to study the sky beyond the Starlink network. SpaceX blamed Thursday's cancellation on a sensor reading. Also this week, flight controllers woke up the crew aboard the International Space Station, or ISS, to hunt down an air leak. ISS Deputy Manager Kenny Todd.
We went through a several-hour activity, and we think we got, again, some more data. We got a finer point on where we think the leak is. We have a leak detector on board, and now we'll start to really put some focus in the service module and try to work with our Russian colleagues to get that taken care of.
NASA says the leak poses no threat to ISS crew. In other news, an underground lake beneath the South Pole on Mars may indicate a network of salty ponds. Italian scientists say this raises the prospect of the existence of microbial Martian life swimming in those waters. The Italian Space Agency's Angela Olivieri.
We are more than satisfied. With this new discovery, it becomes a milestone regarding our understanding of Mars. The Mars's radar can penetrate the subsurface, and for this research, those images obtained are for the most part radiograms.
Scientists based their findings on more than 100 radar observations by the Mars Express mission from 2010 to 2019. The surface temperature at Mars's south pole is minus 113 degrees Celsius but gets warmer below the surface. Researchers suggest future Mars missions target the region. Finally this week, NASA released this promotional video touting the October 31st NASA SpaceX Crew-1 mission bound for the ISS. It will be the first crew rotation mission with four astronauts flying aboard a commercial spacecraft and the first involving an international partner. Soichi Noguchi from Japan's JAXA Space Agency will be on board the flight. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
The pandemic forced rock band Queen and Adam Lambert to cancel 27 shows in 9 countries across Europe that were supposed to be played in the summer 2020, but the band has decided the show must go on. Today, they're releasing their first ever live album, Queen and Adam Live Around the World. It's a compilation of concert highlights from over 200 past concerts all over the world. Lambert, who is now the lead singer, landed the life-changing gig after singing the band's iconic hit Bohemian Rhapsody on the competition show American Idol, where he was backed by the remaining band members on the show's season finale. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you for listening and have a great weekend.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Whoa. Every weekday at 1500 Universal.
Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews. Ooh. Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Ah. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.